So a foundational American value is that all people, regardless of who they are, that they are free to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. There is something that is deep down in our nature that finds this deeply appealing. As Christians, looking at this American value, we can agree on aspects of life, liberty, and happiness, regardless of who you are. Christians can agree that all people, regardless of their gender or their ethnicity, their socioeconomic status, or their moral, ethic, or belief system, has an inalienable right to life and to liberty and to happiness. But here is where Christians diverge from the modern idea of life, liberty, and happiness. Christians believe that the dignity of every single person is empowered by the fact that they are handcrafted in the image of God. Even people who think and live differently as Christians do, and even people who have a different set of beliefs or ethics or morality as Christians do, are made in the image of God. We value life, liberty, and happiness because Jesus died to secure his vision for these things in the lives of people. Jesus' life, death, and resurrection proves that he is the source, the basis of life, liberty, and happiness. And that is something that you can go back and research the American historical record and all the political philosophers of the shaping of our country has never affirmed. That Jesus is the source of every person's life, liberty, and happiness. The Christian sets Jesus as their ultimate priority because of his life, his death, and his resurrection. Now, what does this have to do with today? Today, we're going to see how Jesus challenges any and how Jesus challenges every value that we put in competition with him. It's not that Christians don't have any priorities or any pursuits in life. Christians are also children to parents. They can be spouses. They can be parents. They can be grandparents. They can be family members. They can be friends, citizens, and employees, just like non-Christians. It's that Christians have a desire to set Jesus as their ultimate relationship and their ultimate priority. Because of all that Jesus has done in his life and death and resurrection to secure a relationship with us. And that's what today is about. Then we get to talk about it on Wednesday. Let's get started with our proposition. And what I pray that you see is this, is that Christians look to Jesus as their ultimate priority because Jesus worked towards their ultimate good. Your ultimate good, if you are a Christian, at ultimate cost, ultimate expense to himself. That's what I believe Luke 9 and this portion of Luke 9 is about. So a person's understanding of what we call the gospel is what distinguishes them from a Christian, a non-Christian, or just someone who attends church for whatever reason, because their family attends church, or because maybe they're interested in religion, or maybe they're interested in Jesus. Many people who attend church from one degree to another has one thing in common. They find something about Jesus important, and they find something about church or church community to be important. Many people believe that Jesus is real. That is not a distinctively Christian value. There are many non-Christians that believe in the historical Jesus, that he lived and that he died on a cross and that some claim that he rose again. However, because the gospel is not their ultimate value, they do not consider Jesus, his life, death, and resurrection as their ultimate comfort and their ultimate relationship. They may believe in Jesus, believe that Jesus is real, but they don't live for Jesus above all. And that's a difference between a Christian, someone who attends church, and a non-Christian. But this is the thing. If this is you in our congregation today, I pray you can hear this. If you are ever going to move past just attending church or partaking in some of the practices that we focus on here at Branchton, you need to wrestle through, and then I pray, accept that the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus is proof that he's the ultimate relationship in life and that he is the ultimate priority in life. And that being a Christian doesn't mean you go into a huddle and you just, you know, close your hands and you sit there and pray all day. Because Christians are also in relationships as parents, as spouses, as employees, as citizens, right? As friends. So today we're going to see how Jesus speaks to three people who, for whatever reason, thought that they followed Jesus for some period of time. And we're going to see how Jesus spoke about himself to them as ultimate relationship and ultimate priority. And then we're going to consider how to set and how to keep Jesus as our ultimate priority when we're tempted to live another way. Because we acknowledge that even Christians get out of tune. We need to come back to the objective tuner and tune our hearts to sing his praise. And then we're going to come to the table, which I think is a beautiful mixture today of the sermon and then response coming to the table. Let's get started with our first point. And what you're going to see from this exchange that Jesus has with these three people is that Christians prioritize following Jesus, as we sang moments ago, above all else, above all comforts, and above all relationships. And we need to see what this means and what it doesn't mean. Christians set Jesus as their ultimate comfort and their ultimate relationship because it is Jesus alone that paid the highest cost to secure your greatest comfort and your greatest relationship, which is a relationship with his Father. And as a result of this, over time, this is the incredibly awesome, scary, and joyful thing that happens to Christians. Over time, Christians begin to prioritize following Jesus above the comforts and the relationships that they used to turn to find ultimate meaning. This is essentially what Jesus teaches the three people in our text today. So let's get started. So the first person approaches Jesus and says to Jesus, I will follow you wherever you may go. Now, in the first century in Israel, telling a rabbi, a Jewish rabbi, I want to follow you, is telling him, I want to be your disciple, and I want you to be my master. It was a very specific thing in this culture and society. Now, doesn't that sound like devotion? Right? This guy is sold out. I will follow you wherever you go. That sounds like this person wants to prioritize Jesus above all things, right? He would be lifting his arms today during the worship service as our worship leader saying, above all else, I adore your name. But here's some more information for you. In first century Jewish culture and practice, rabbis called disciples. Disciples, potential disciples, didn't get to choose who their rabbi was. They were selected. They were elected. All right. When a rabbi calls a disciple to follow him, the agreement is this. The disciple adopts all that the master teaches, does all that the master says, and all that the master does. And I believe that following Jesus can begin when you understand that it's Jesus that calls people to follow him. And some of you may say, well, I've never had the call yet. If you come, I pray, to our church in a weekly basis, you hear every single time, Jesus is calling you to follow him more than you did before you walked into this room. I pray that's what happens. I pray the gospel is preached. You see, it's never our own natural human idea. Like, no one wakes up and says, they stretch, they turn their alarm off, and I just want to give everything to you today, Jesus. No one naturally does that. No one does. But Jesus, because he is fully God, he knows our hearts completely. And he knows it better than we do. And as Christians, we must look at life with that framework every day. That God and his word knows me infinitely better than I do. Jesus can see past our words and into what is really going on inside of us. And Jesus alone can do this. And I want you to see with that context how Jesus responds to this declaration of devotion. Let's look at verse 58. Jesus says, "The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." You got to ask yourself this question. Why do you think Jesus responded to this person in this way? Why does he start talking about birds and foxes and then connect it to himself? I think this is it. Underneath the declaration of devotion, this person cared more for physical comfort and security than following Jesus. And this is the reality as we come into this place today. I don't think this man is alone. In the history of humanity and people who have claimed to follow Jesus, I do not think this man, singularly and uniquely alone, has struggled with that. Of putting comfort and security, your own safety, above Jesus. I think many people who think that they follow Jesus deep down want physical comfort more than following Jesus. Now, to you, Jesus' response may seem startling, does it not? He gives the person the truth. Following Jesus means you're going to follow a person who is poor. If you're looking for physical comfort, and if you're looking for physical security in this life, foxes have holes and birds have nests, but he has nowhere to lay his head. But then you have to add this into the mix. Christians believe that Jesus is God who created all things. Jesus is the creator and the sustainer and the owner of all things. He owns the cattle on a thousand hills, as the psalmist says. But at the incarnation, when Jesus took on human flesh, Jesus pushed all of that away. And he clothed himself with poverty. He wasn't born in David's house, though he was born in David's town. He wasn't born in Caesar's palace in Rome. He was born in an offshoot village outside of Jerusalem. That wasn't even his parents' home. No room for them. Born in a stinky, dirty manger. And then you add on to that, where did Jesus grow up? Well, at first he had to go to Egypt, right? Because someone wanted to kill him. And his developmental years were actually spent outside of the Jews' country. But then when he went back, he was raised in Nazareth. I mean, does anything good come out of Nazareth? That's what people say about that town. This is our God. Foxes have holes and birds have nests. Jesus has nowhere to lay his head. Physical comfort can become a priority over following Jesus. And it doesn't matter if you've been a Christian for a day or decades. That's the reality. In Tolkien's The Hobbit, the main character of the novel and the movie is a hobbit by the name of Bilbo Baggins. He's described as a halfling, which means he's not tall in stature. He would be no taller than, you know, like a child would be. That's the hero of our story. In the beginning of the novel, Bilbo, this half-sized person, is invited to become part of a company and a fellowship that is going on this grand adventure. And he is invited by the supernatural being and this king. Because this king used to have a country, used to have a people, but it was overtaken. And he has this desire to take his country back, to restore the glory and splendor of his people who have been oppressed since then. And out of all people, someone who is this tall gets invited to play a critical role in this company to make that happen. It's such an engaging story. And at first, Bilbo says no. He flat out refuses to become part of this company. And you want to know why? It was all about physical comfort for Bilbo. One of the dwarves said, "You care more about your doilies and your larder than you care for people." And he's right. It was all about his personal comfort, because he lived in this place that's called the Shire. And whether you've watched the movies or not, this place is idyllic. Always the perfect temperature, beautiful food, yummy food, fellowship of family and friends, right there all around you. Anything and everything you would ever want was found in the Shire, and you don't ever need to leave. Bilbo has every physical comfort available to him in his home. If you're able to watch the Peter Jackson trilogy and just take a look at his larder, you'd see why he'd never want to leave home. Bilbo couldn't commit to this adventure of a lifetime because of the creature comforts of home. He was too comfortable to accept the invitation at first. Thank God. I believe this is what Jesus is saying to the first person. And because Tolkien was a Christian, I think he's trying to communicate this to us as his reader. Christians, Christ followers, prioritize Jesus over physical creature comforts. That's what we learn from this. And I believe that this is a struggle for many people. And I believe that this could be a struggle for many people even in this room. I actually believe that being a person in this room solidifies and amplifies the tension of wanting creature comforts. Prioritizing these creature comforts will lull you into a false sense of security. Christians follow Jesus because he was rich, he was king, yet he gave all of it up for you and for me. Now let's take a look at the second person. In verse 59, the traditional rabbi thing happens. Rabbi goes to somebody and says, "I'm inviting you. You follow me." But then take a look at the response. This person says, "Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father." So Jesus invites the second person to follow him. And you need to take a hard look at the second person's response. This person replies to Jesus and says, "Jesus, first, I have to go bury my father." Now this resonates, I think, in all of us. We have all been touched by the death of a loved one to one degree or another. The death of a family member is a difficult test of faith. Which is why I made the decision 2 days after my mom died of COVID, our worship leader is out of town, and I'm leading worship, weeping over Amazing Grace while leading worship. Because the death of a loved one draws these things out unlike anything else. So we have to take a look at how Jesus responds to this person. Let's take a look at verse 60. Death. And this is how Jesus responds. This is our Jesus. This is Christianity. Jesus says, "Allow the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God." I think to continue today, you have to ask yourself, does Jesus have a negative view of family? I mean, does he? Why does Jesus respond to this man who has lost his dad and say, "Allow the dead to bury their dead, and you follow me"? I do not believe that Jesus is being cold, nor is he being callous towards this person, nor towards this person's family. You have to remember that Jesus isn't like some god that the cosmos created, like ancient Mesopotamian gods. Jesus is a one and only begotten son of a father. Do you remember that? Jesus has a father. So what is Jesus doing here? To be a Christian, to follow Jesus means that his people grow, and we've spoken about this on Wednesday nights back in the days of the marker board, and I'll just do a little squiggly line. So even though it feels like this, still, Christians grow. And we grow to prioritize Jesus as our most important relationship. Okay. Now, once again, we must remember that as Creator, that we are made in his image, Jesus knows us better than we know ourselves. There's a clue right now in the second person's response that helps us understand what's going on. He says, "Let me first go and bury my father." First declares priority, right? Here's some more information about what life is like for a Jew in first century Middle Eastern culture. A Jew in the first century followed a particular way of honoring their dead. I mean, every culture, you can at least understand, every culture has different values about their dead, different values that they follow and they do. Nonetheless, is it true for first century Jewish culture? Their ritual for memorializing the dead is called Shavah. It's just the Hebrew term for the number 7. That's it. And what this means is that if the man's father had just died, this man wouldn't be around Jesus. If he just died, he would be at home with his family and the whole entire community for 7 days, remembering and weeping and lamenting the death of the father for 7 days. That's the cultural tradition that's going on right here. And that lets you know Jesus is not cold and callous towards family. What this means is that what the person is saying to Jesus isn't really what's going on inside their heart. Can you see that? Good. It is almost as if, I'm inferencing here, that he uses family as an excuse to not follow Jesus. And once again, I do not think in the history of every single person who has claimed to follow Jesus that this man is alone. Actually, there's a third person next that sounds just like him. I believe that this is a true reality of every single person who thinks they follow Jesus. Now let's take a look at the third person. Verse 61. So this third person goes to Jesus and says, "I will follow you." But then he thinks about it a split second later, right? I've had some time to think about it over the weekend. I'm scared to do this now. So, but, first, permit me to say goodbye to those at home. This person initiates and says, I'll follow you. But then he immediately thinks twice and says, but. Buts is a contrast word. It is meant to oppose what was said before with what is said afterwards. Now let me help you for a moment understand what could be going on in this statement. Could you imagine all of those years ago when I proposed to Tisa at intermission at a show at the Straz on the Riverwalk, sat her down on a bench, and I said, "Tisa, will you marry me?" And Tisa says, "Joe, I'll marry you." Pause. You notice semicolon, right? Two different things going on. I think there's a little bit of time right there. And Tisa is sitting on the bench. She goes, "I'll marry you, Joe, but." Mm-hmm. You know where this is going, right? Helps us understand what's going on underneath, maybe, with this third person. That kind of response sets up conditions and stipulations for entering a relationship. And what this means is that this third person is putting conditions on following Jesus. I will only be a Christian if you let me do this, 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 and this my way. He will only follow Jesus. In his case, if he goes back home and says goodbye to those who are at home. But remember, the relationship that exists in first century Judaism that's being discovered and developed here is that between a rabbi and a student, a master and a disciple. Yet this person puts conditions on the master. This person, so the first person puts comfort above Jesus. And person two and person three puts family above Jesus. But all three people, putting it together, puts things and puts relationships as more of a priority than Jesus. But right here, I want to put up another example side by side. I want you to think about the first four people who followed Jesus. Simon, Andrew, James, and John. We've preached on them this year. This was intentional. This was January. Simon, Andrew, James, and John. All four of these men were fishermen. Strong, probably stinky because of the fish, sweaty. They used their hands to provide for their families. James and John were also in a joint venture enterprise with their father, Zebedee, with their occupation. It was family business. Jesus, as rabbis do, made the invitation to all four. We don't see Simon and Andrew and James and John just saying, hey, Jesus, I want to follow, I'll follow you wherever. Simon doesn't do that until a little bit later. He makes that declaration. He's dead wrong. Simon and Andrew, James and John, left their nets, put their keyboard away. That would be me. And followed Jesus. Peter was a husband. James and John was working for their dad. What does this mean? I think what this means is that if you're going to continue with Jesus, whether you're a Christian, you're a non-Christian and you're here, you got to figure this out. Why did these four men do this? Why did four men leave their financial security, their physical comfort, and their families to follow this Jewish rabbi? And I think this is the answer. Peter and Andrew and James and John found something in Jesus that they were never going to find in fishing and family. Never. Now, let's add this to it. Shortly after Simon, Peter, began following Jesus, his mother-in-law became ill. Do you remember that? So if Jesus is so callous towards family, why would Jesus go into the mother-in-law's home and heal her? Right? The answer is more complex than the simple answers that we like. Now add on to this. As Jesus is suffering for the sins and sorrows, the injustice and evil that we've committed and that were committed against us, his mom was there. John's gospel gives us this detail. This is moments before he gives up the ghost. He bows his head and gives up his spirit. Jesus calls his mother to him, and then he calls John, his disciple, to him. And basically says, John, this is now your mom. I want you to take care of her. Mary has, despite what the Catholics think, Mary has sons and daughters who could fit that bill. Why does Jesus tell John, this is now your mom? And then John takes her into his home after that. If Jesus is cold and callous about family, right? Point, this topic is so much more complex. Why is it that sometimes Jesus seems overwhelmingly for family, and then at other times he says, let the dead bury their dead? You know, both of these things put together, this is called an antinomy right now. I'm putting two contrasting ideas in front of you so that you can understand the gospel. And it's not simple. Being a Christian isn't simple. If you're looking for simplicity, I think it's somewhere else. I think the answer is, why is Jesus so overwhelmingly for families sometimes, and sometimes like, what? Because it has to do with that particular person's heart motivation. I think that's why. Let's take a look at how Jesus responds to the third person now. He says to him, no one, after putting his hand to the plow and then looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. Jesus uses a farming illustration. I think to one degree or another we can get this. A farmer who has been given a field to plow and to tend and to take care of and then just gives up on the crop isn't worthy of farming. Go find a different occupation, right? Go sit at a keyboard, right, like I do all day. Likewise, a person who says, I will follow Jesus, you will be my master, yet consistently, emphasis, consistently, prioritizes their own comfort and their own family over Jesus is not a Christian. Consistently. Not perfectly, but consistently. You cannot be a Christian if your greatest priority and your greatest relationship is not Jesus. 5 chapters later, Jesus helps us out with this idea a little bit more. It comes from Luke 14. Let's take a look at it. Luke 14, verses 25 and 26. I put in 25 so you'd see the context of the quote. There are large crowds that are following Jesus. Large crowds. He turns to this large crowd of people. He's not in synagogue. The church isn't even around yet. Just a crowd of people. He turns to them, and here's what he says. One of the hardest statements in the New Testament. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father, mother, wife, and children, brothers and sisters, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Right? I'm bringing out the tension right now on purpose. Why does Jesus tell John, like, this is your mom now, and then says something like this? Remember, large crowds were following Jesus. And this means we can, I think, correctly conclude that there were mixed motivations in the crowd that day. Are we okay with that? Some people probably just wanted to be healed. They were blind, they were deaf, they were demon, whatever it may be. They wanted healing from Jesus. Or maybe some of the people wanted their loved one, friend or family member to be healed. And that's why they're following Jesus. That's why they're in the crowd. Some may have wanted to see the crazy supernatural thing that Jesus would do next, because word about him spread. Maybe they heard, Jesus is a pretty good baker, and I want to taste his bread. And maybe some truly loved and followed him, considered him to be the bread of life. He speaks this same message to all kinds of people in the crowd that day. Jesus is not saying that you must literally hate and reject family members if you are to be a Christian. However, when you put your love for Jesus and your love for another thing or another person, and you set it side by side, love for Jesus must look stronger. That's what he's saying. Let me help you understand this. I hope you're discovering this, whether you've been here for a hot minute or you've been here for a while. I love each of you. I love each of you in different ways. For different reasons and different levels. I'm human. Let me explain. If I put my love for you and then took my love for Tisa and I drew it out and I put it side by side, right? You know where I'm going. You're going to see that love for Tisa is infinitely greater. But I love you, right? Does it mean that I don't love you? I love her infinitely more than you. I pray you'd say, and pray for me and keep it going, right? Jesus, therefore, is not calling you to love family and people less. He is calling you that when the time comes, because sometimes these relationships force the issue, and you put these two relationships side by side, Jesus and the other person, that in that situation, love for Jesus is shown to be different and higher. And it doesn't diminish my love for you or for her. Because honestly, I pray, put my love for Jesus, love for Tisa, and love for y'all side by side by side. I don't have three hands. I'm not Shiva. But if you have a third hand in Jesus, right? It doesn't diminish the other loves. It just shows the grandeur of what the ultimate love is. That is what Jesus is saying in Luke 14. If you've decided to follow Jesus, this is the reality. Earthly comfort, creature comforts, and family, those intimate relationships, are going to tempt you at one point, at some point, to deprioritize Jesus and overprioritize them. So what's a Christian to do? That's our application now. So let's get to it. So I think it is beautiful that we're doing the Lord's table in just a moment. Because we have to remember. I hope Lauren Daigle played that song last night. I remember. Did she do that one last night? No? We remember. In remembrance. We remind ourselves of how Jesus redeemed you when you are tempted to prioritize your creature comforts and your physical, earthly relationships over him. That's what Christians do. It's going to come, Branchton. It's already come, I think, virtually for all of us. So we're in good company. Let's talk about it. As a Christian, or if you're just someone who is interested in Jesus, you're just here, you're not a Christian, but you're here. At some point, you are going to be put in a position to decide who your ultimate relationship is and what your ultimate priorities are going to be. And the gospel says, Jesus says, a human being was not created to serve two masters. Simon and Andrew and James and John couldn't follow Jesus as a disciple and then literally follow somebody else at the same time. We were not created for this. We were created for undivided, singular, focused devotion, which is why I believe in the history of humanity that monogamous relationships have been the dominant relationship and monarchy has been the ultimate form of government. Doesn't matter where on the planet, but that's something for a different time. Food for thought. If you're interested in Jesus, but haven't made Jesus a priority. Or, if you're here today and you are a Christian, but if you're honest, you're prioritizing your creature comforts, your own safety, your own security, and your own family over Jesus, what do you do? What do you do? That's what this application is about. And the application is, you must remember, and you must personally experience the cost that Jesus paid for you on the cross. That's always going to be the answer. The death and resurrection of Jesus means that he wants to be your ultimate creature comfort. That he wants to be your ultimate relationship. Because in reality, there is no creature comfort and there is no relationship out there that compares what Jesus did for you on the cross. God became man. Perfect took on evil and died for it. What else compares to that? I want you to think about it another way. On a human level, just on a human level, forget about God for a moment. Just on a human level, why is it that fishermen, Jewish fishermen like Peter and Andrew and James and John, prioritize Jesus over fishing and finances and family? Why is it that rich tax collectors like Matthew, and then in a couple weeks we're going to look at Zacchaeus? How is it that people like that prioritize Jesus over their financial security? And then on the other hand, I'm bringing together a contrast for you to create some tension. But then on the other hand, on a human level, why is it that people like the scribes, the Pharisees, the rich young ruler, which we're looking at next Sunday, These three would-be followers in Luke 9 prioritized creature comfort, wealth or power, or authority or family over Jesus. On a human level, I think this is the answer. One set had a personal experience, and the other set did not. They both heard the natural call, follow me. One had a personal experience, a meaningful, eternal, personal experience, and the others did not. The first disciples discovered something in Jesus that others refused to see, that Jesus is infinitely better than all earthly creature comfort and all earthly relationships. And in our application, before we come to the table, I want to share with you two verses to help you see this. The first one comes from 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9. 2 Corinthians 8 is Paul's teaching on how you should view wealth and how Christians should be committed to generosity. And in the middle of this teaching on Christian wealth and generosity, Paul says this: "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, through his poverty, might become rich." This is written by the Apostle Paul. He was of the wealthy, ruling Jewish class, a conservative Pharisee. He was a tent maker and a Pharisee. He was a who's who in Jewish culture, an up-and-coming Pharisee. He defended the Jewish faith against the first Jewish Christians who defected from Yahweh and from Israel. Yet Paul became a Christian. He gave up the tribe of Benjamin and Pharisaic living to follow Jesus. Once again, on a human level, what did Paul find in Jesus that he didn't find in his position or in his wealth or in his family? Paul had an eternally personal, meaningful experience with Jesus when he was traveling to persecute some Christians from Jerusalem up to Damascus. That is always the answer. That is always what separates Christians from those who are religious or from the non-Christian. We have had an eternally personal experience with this Jesus. As God, Jesus created everything. And when Jesus took on flesh, he gave up everything. Rich became poor. King became slave. Foxes have holes. Birds have nests. But Jesus had nowhere to lay his head. Why did Jesus do this? Paul says right here, he did all of this, king, slave, rich to poor, for your sake. That's why he did it. It's something we get to rejoice in today. We find this beautiful about Jesus. Giving up wealth, this is what Jesus does. This is what Christians do. That's what it means to be Christian. The way up is down, right? Or the way down is up. The way to be rich is to become poor. The way to be first is to be last. The way to life is through death. Jesus gave up power, authority, and riches. And he took on weakness and poverty for you. And let's ask the text why. There's a "so that" right there. Do you see it? It's because Jesus's weakness, through Jesus's weakness and through his poverty, you can become stronger and you can become richer than any comfort or relationship in this world can offer to you. That's why he did it. Christians like Peter and Andrew and James and John and Matthew and Paul personally experienced this. They found a wealth in Jesus that no amounts of security and safety and earthly wealth could compare to. So, Christian, you will be tempted to put your job and to put money and financial security, your own physical security, your own physical comforts above Jesus. And it's when that happens, you must remember that king became slave, innocent hung on a cross, rich became poor. You have to fight back with those truths. And when this happens, you must remember, Jesus was king who became slave, rich who became poor, so those who are poor can become rich in an eternally more meaningful way than just eternal riches. Sorry, than just physical earthly riches. Second text, Matthew 27, verse 46. Matthew tells us that the ninth hour of the day, this is on the cross, that Jesus cried out. Doesn't sound like a man who's just about to die. This is krazo, a crazed scream. Krazo in Greek. And here's what he cries out. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. My God, why have you forsaken me? On the cross, yes, Jesus felt utter, unparalleled, physical, emotional, and spiritual devastation. I do not mean to diminish this. He took on the weight and he paid the cost of what sin and sorrow and suffering and evil and injustice has done to us, and the sin and sorrow and suffering and evil and injustice that we've caused in the lives of others. I'm not diminishing that. But I do not believe that that was the greatest thing that he experienced on the cross. I think this is. At Jesus' baptism, God the Father declared to everyone, this is my agape, my agapato, my beloved son, my one and only son. I am well pleased with him. And then at the cross, God was silent. At the cross, God the Father abandoned God the Son. In the lost son's parable that we spent 2 weeks going through, both knucklehead sons had a dad to pursue them. But at the cross, Jesus had no father to pursue him. That's why dealing with my sin, my hurts, isn't the greatest thing Jesus has had to do. This was the greatest thing that Jesus had to do. And you have to ask, Jesus, you became fatherless on the cross. God, why would you do this? Why would you do this? Jesus took on the death that you deserve so you can take on the life that he deserves. Those who put their hope in Jesus, those who follow Jesus, are adopted into Jesus' family with Jesus as our true elder brother who will pursue us. And Jesus' father as our adopted father. Now, many people who attend church, they like Jesus. And maybe some of them may even say, I love Jesus. He's important, but he is not their most important relationship. He's not more important than their own physical family. So what this means, if this is you, is that you both underestimate and you underappreciate all that God has done for you in the life, death, and resurrection of his one and only Son. And I also think that it means that you misunderstand just how serious your sin and suffering and sorrow, evil and injustice that has been thrown your way is, and what you've done to others. Christian, you are going to be tempted to put family relationships above your relationships with Jesus. When you do, you must remember king became slave, rich became poor, that through his poverty, you might become rich in a way that pales in comparison. That Jesus stood on the cross and couldn't feel him as father. So this is the one time he didn't call him Abba. So one time he just called him God because he couldn't feel God's fatherly hand. Why? For you. When you are tempted to deprioritize Jesus and then replace him with your creature comforts and with family, you need to remind yourself of all that the Godhead did for you in the cross of Jesus.